As Richard said, yesterday morning I returned from a 2.5 week placement with the Anglican Department of Evangelism in Sydney. And during my stay there, I couldn't get out of my mind the words of an English vicar I met out there. He said this, "Rico, it is so hard to speak to the Australians about heaven because they think they're already there." And it is indeed a land of great beauty and plenty. Most families in Sydney, I'm told, expect to have 1/4 acre of land with their first home. I was there in midwinter and kept getting sunburned. One is left speechless by the grandeur of the Blue Mountains on the one hand and the hundreds of miles of golden Pacific beaches on the other. And unsurprisingly, according to the staff in the Department of Evangelism, living in that land of plenty makes most Australians unthinking hedonists. That's what they called them. As 2 Timothy 3 verse 4 would say, they're lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Their slogan is that of the rich fool in Luke chapter 12, eat, drink and be merry. I met up with an English rugby friend who I knew in student days, and I said, "Andy, are you ever coming back to England?" And he instantly said, "No, Rico, never. Just look at this place." But Australia is not heaven. Chillingly, this came home to me when I visited an old people's home, hidden behind a huge row of trees, out of sight, out of mind. And I realized something that I'd forgotten for the previous week. It hit me like a sledgehammer. Australians die as well. We visited an 86-year-old man in this home, who died 4 days after we visited him. And he had, by all accounts, been a wonderful Christian servant. But when we saw him, he wasn't able to speak. He wasn't able to perform the usual bodily functions alone. His teeth were out and he was being spoon-fed yogurt. His eyes were glazed. And his only means of communication was moving his right index finger. He could just move that. Now, at that stage of his life, for this man, George Piper, I guess there was only one question that was relevant for him as he sat in that home. Only one question, and that is this. Who will lead me to heaven? Who will lead me to heaven? Who will get me there? Who will rescue me from Luke 1 verse 79? Can we look down and see it there on the right-hand side? Who will rescue me halfway down from the shadow of death? Who will do that? There were horses playing outside his window, but they meant nothing to him. Who will rescue me from the shadow of death, the shadow in which we all stand? And here in this passage, Zechariah, an elderly, childless priest, celebrates not the birth of his first son, not the fact that he's seen an angel, not the restoration of his speech, but the fact that his son will, verse 76, prepare the way for one who will. Can we see it? It's in verse 74. If we look down, one who will, right at the bottom of the page, left-hand column, rescue his people from the hand of our enemies and enable us to serve without fear. So Jesus, this promised leader, the one we remember tonight in this communion, is one who rescues us from our sin and by his resurrection power leads us out of the shadow of death. And this dying man, George Piper, was reminded of those great truths by the clergyman I was with, a man called Dave Mansfield. And though he could only physically acknowledge them with his index finger, that's all he could do. That is what he was reminded of. And when we got into the car to leave, Dave, who was shaken by seeing George, a great friend, in such a state, said, "I was with George, this same man, 16 years ago when his wife Peggy died. He was obviously shattered by her death, but as I left his house that night that she died, he said to me, 'I am distraught at my wife's death, distraught. But in my grief I know this, Dave,'" and this is what he said on the night his wife died, "'because of Jesus, Peggy is now in heaven. Because of Jesus, I too will soon be in heaven. And I just want to give the rest of my life to helping others to trust Jesus so that they could be in heaven too.'" So George had absolute confidence in Jesus to rule and to rescue him. Question, do you and I? absolute confidence in the shadow of death, of his wife's death, of his own death, in Jesus. Now as we turn to the story of King Rehoboam in 2 Chronicles, we have to ask ourselves, what sort of leader was he? Was this man a leader who could save his people? Was he trustworthy? Does he, Luke 1 verse 74, does he rescue his people from the hand of their enemies? Does he do that? Luke 1 verse 79, does he guide their feet into the path of peace? That's the question with Rehoboam. So let's turn to the story of this king in the Blue Bibles, page 445, 2 Chronicles chapter 10 if we can. If we can nip back with those questions in mind, what sort of leader will he be? Page 445. And as we turn, let's remember, page 445, that the key to understanding the monarchy in the light of Christ is to ask, does this king rule and rescue his people as a promise of Christ, or does he blow it? So does he live and rule in obedience and lead his people to blessing, or does he live in disobedience and inflict disaster on his people? And of course, in 1 Chronicles, we've been given an example of both kings, both models. There's King Saul, who tragically will not inquire of the Lord. Instead, he inquires of the witch at Endor, and not only perishes himself, but leads his people to military defeat and his own family to slaughter, because he will not inquire of the Lord. And then there is King David, who does inquire of the Lord and dies in old age, having led his people to peace, prosperity, and military conquest. And the chronicler asks those listeners, his first readers in exile, he says, who are you going to go with? Are you going to go with Saul, or are you going to go with David? Are you going to inquire of the Lord, or are you going to ignore him? And so now, what will Rehoboam do? Will his leadership, his rule, result in rescue and peace, or will it lead to disaster because of his disobedience and the disobedience he leads his people into? Well, sadly, if we can just flick over the page to 2 Chronicles 12, verse 14, we have the chronicler's clear assessment of Rehoboam's reign. And it is not a flattering epitaph. This is so sad. What a desperate epitaph. Verse 12 of chapter 12, if we look down. Sorry, verse 14. 2 Chronicles 12, verse 14. This is the epitaph. He did evil because he had not set his heart on seeking the Lord. And in many ways, the evil which occurred in Rehoboam's reign could not have been worse. For we see, as the sermon points out, if you've got your sermon sheets, we see that in this reign, the kingdom splits. A disastrous schism takes place, which permanently breaks up the people of God. So Rehoboam doesn't lead his people into peace, but into divorce. The family breaks up. In chapter 10, we'll see the 10 northern kingdoms led by a man named Jeroboam declare unilateral independence and set up a new capital away from Jerusalem in Samaria. Rehoboam is left with just two tribes, those of Benjamin and Judah. And from his reign on, the story of God's people is the story of two kingdoms, not of one. There's the larger northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, that's called Israel. And there's the smaller southern kingdom, that's Judah. So let's see how Rehoboam utterly fails to rule and rescue his people as a pattern and promise of the Messiah king to come. And as his reign goes on, we'll see three things happen. In chapter 10, we'll see failure. In chapter 11, we see success. And then in chapter 12, we move to disaster. So those are the three headings. Failure, success, disaster. And to a degree, as I've studied Rehoboam in the last couple of weeks, I've been unable to get the tragic, fatal plane flight and disaster of John F. Kennedy Jr. out of my mind. Time and again, it's reminded me of that plane trip. Time magazine led with this headline about that plane trip. It said this: he was America's prince, an icon of both magic and grief, who flew his own course to the lost horizon. That's what it said. But as you know, the sad truth is that barring any discoveries of mechanical failure, which may yet be discovered, but it seems the truth is that that Kennedy flew with a basic disregard of the basic rules of aviation. He took off without a flight plan. He ignored a descending mist that grounded another pilot, also going to Martha's Vineyard. He chose a quicker route over water rather than a safer flight route over land. He flew without the skills to fly blind using the plane's instruments. He was utterly reckless as he set off. Most tragic of all, those in his care, his wife and his sister-in-law, died with him. So his flight to the far horizon disastrously affected others, those in his care, those he was leading. And that's exactly what we see now with Rehoboam. We see his flight disastrously affect others. We see the same tragedy played out. And it begins in chapter 10, page 445, with failure. Can we see it? Failure. Chapter 10. Apparently, Hillary Clinton is conducting a listening tour of New York at the moment. Well, Rehoboam should have taken a leaf out of her book, because what characterizes his behavior in chapter 10 is his refusal to listen to the flight plan of either his people or the elders who had served his father Solomon. He will not listen. Let's see him do that in verses 1 to 8. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was in Egypt where he had fled from King Solomon, he returned from Egypt. So they sent to Jeroboam, and he and all Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." Rehoboam answered, "Come back to me in 3 days." So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. "How would you advise me to answer these people?" he asked. They replied, "If you will be kind to these people and please them and give them a favorable answer, they'll always be your servants." But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who'd grown up with him and were serving him. So let's see what happens here. The people ask for relief, verse 4, from taxation, forced labor, and the policy of centralization that they'd experienced under Solomon. And their request is mirrored by the elders to assure King Rehoboam that if he is kind, that's a key word, do you see it in verse 7? If you will be kind, then the people will always be your servants. So question, will Rehoboam be kind? Will he be a pattern for the Messiah King who in Luke 1 verse 72 shows mercy and rescues his people from their enemies so that they can serve him without fear? Will he free his people to serve? Will he be kind? No. No. In verses 8 to 14, he shows himself to be totally unsympathetic to their burden. In fact, on the advice of the young men, verse 8, which in the Hebrew translation literally means the lads, that's what they're called here in verse 8, on the advice of the lads, those were his half-brothers he'd grown up with in the royal palace, on the advice of the lads, he promises to oppress Israel and lead it back towards the slavery which it had experienced in Pharaoh's day. He's not going to release them and rescue them, he's actually going to push them back into the slavery that they'd known under Pharaoh. We see that in verses 8 to 14 if we look down. But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who'd grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, "What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke your father has put on us'?" The young men who had grown up with him replied, "Tell the people who have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter.' Tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips, I'll scourge you with scorpions.'" 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said. "Come back to me in 3 days." The king answered them harshly, rejecting the advice of the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, "My father made your yoke heavy, I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions." So this king is harsh. There is no tender mercy. There's no empathy here. He cannot be trusted to lead them kindly. And his words are all the more unpalatable for the fact that they're delivered in a vulgar adolescent rhyme. They're full of rhetorical tricks. So the phrase, my little finger in verse 10, is actually a play on words referring to his own sexual organs. Whilst the phrase, the people in verse 10, is a word normally used for children. So he actually says in verse 10, tell the children, that's how he refers to his own people, that I will scourge them with scorpions. Scorpions were whips tipped with weights and barbs. Had the people of Israel in captivity in Egypt known such whips? He was going to show them such whips. Question. Would you trust this guy to fly your plane? Would you get on a flight with him? Would you get on board? You certainly would not have done that if you were the chronicler's original Jewish readers in exile, because they knew the words of the prophet Isaiah, who in Isaiah 3 verse 5 warns them that the rule and advice of young men as opposed to older men is the difference between the base and the honourable. Isaiah has very little respect for young men and for their ability to rule. So to submit to Rehoboam would be to go the way of folly, not least because we've already seen in Chronicles that a key element of godly leadership is to seek and follow wise advice. Chronicles is always saying, who are these people listening to? It's asking you and I, who are we listening to? Whose advice do we heed? Do we listen to the lad? Or do we listen to God and to the old and the wise? So now in verse 16, Rehoboam's folly precipitates the split of the kingdom. And he's undoubtedly relied on his family pedigree to guarantee his rule. And so they sarcastically answer that family pedigree. They answer him in verse that mocks his great-grandfather Jesse. So they chant, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? Jesse's a commoner. They say, we're not going to follow the Davidic line now. We're not going to follow you. Furthermore, the cry, if you look down, again, in verse 16, to your tent, O Israel, that is a war cry. The Israelites will now go to war to stop this man ruling them. It is so ironic. He's meant to lead them into peace, but actually they end up at war with him. And what is Rehoboam's reaction to their rejection, to this split? What does he do at the end of verse 16? Does he say, look, I'm sorry? Does he actually say, I must act with kindness? Is there reconciliation here? No, quite the opposite. Instead, in verse 18, if we look down, he sends out a man named Adoniram, the man in charge of forced labour, as his negotiator. Now that is rather like sending out McDonald's to negotiate with a national vegetarian. I mean, that's just the wrong thing to do. The guy's got the wrong image. It's in fact an attempt to intimidate them. And unsurprisingly, the man is killed. So rather than ruling his people, Rehoboam ends up at the end of the chapter jumping into his chariot to escape them. And so the chronicler concludes the chapter very sadly, verse 19, so Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. That is what Rehoboam has done. Rehoboam's reign has begun with a terrible failure because he would not listen to wise advice, and so the kingdom split. In chapter 11, however, as we move on, we find that Rehoboam's failure is followed by some relative success. So he goes from failure to success. And that is the second point in the flight plan. Failure, chapter 10, to success in chapter 11. In fact, we can see the success of chapter 11 outlined in the first verse of chapter 12, if we look down. Can we see it over the page, page 446? Here we see how successful he was in chapter 11. After Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong. It's a good period, those 3 years of chapter 11. And his reign flourishes in three ways. In three ways he establishes and strengthens himself. In verses 5 to 11, we see there's prosperity and power. I won't read them, but that's what happens in 5 to 11. As Rehoboam builds up the military defences of Judah. Secondly, in verses 13 to 17, he enjoys popular support as many priests and Levites abandon their pasture lands and property in the north and come to Jerusalem to serve at the temple. So they said, we want to be faithful to Jerusalem, to the Davidic line, and they come. And many people follow them. And look, there are people of blessing that arrive in verse 16 if you look down. Every tribe of Israel who had set their hearts on seeking the Lord goes to Jerusalem. So suddenly they're flooded with people who want to seek the Lord. So we see there's success in prosperity and power. There's success in popular support. And lastly, we see in verses 18 to 23, there is success, and I'm sorry, this is the only P I could find, in progeny. We see that actually he has offspring. So large families, to the chronicler, are a sign of great blessing, and Rehoboam has a huge family. So there's prosperity and power, popular support, and progeny. And why? Why did Rehoboam experience such success? Well, the chronicler is very clear about that. We can see why he had such success, and it's at the start of the chapter in verse 4. Can we see it, verse 4? This is why, at the end of verse 4, Rehoboam enjoyed success. So they obeyed the words of the Lord and turned back from marching against Jeroboam. Rehoboam and Judah were enjoying the blessings of obedience for the time they obeyed the words of the prophet Shemaiah in verse 3 and did not go to war. The prophet appeared, he said, do not go to war. They obeyed him, and there was 3 years of success and prosperity. And surely Rehoboam would now learn his lesson. Surely he'd say, right, I've found out where I can flourish. If I go the Lord's way, I must do that. Surely he's going to get his reign back on track. He must have learned the lessons of chapter 11. But no. In chapter 12, we go from failure to success, from failure in chapter 10 to success in chapter 11. Now in chapter 12, we hit disaster. And the reason is made abundantly clear in chapter 12, verses 1 to 5. The country is invaded, the fortifications that he's built are overrun. And why? Why does this happen? Well, again, the prophet Shemaiah appears on the scene and tells us. Let's read chapter 12, verses 1 to 5, if you can look down. After Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong, he and all Israel with him abandoned the law of the Lord because they'd been unfaithful to the Lord. Shishak, because they'd been unfaithful, this king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of King Rehoboam. With 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen and the innumerable troops of Libyans, Sukkites and Cushites, they came with him from Egypt. He captured the 45 cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. Then the prophet Shemaiah came to Rehoboam and to the leaders of Judah who had assembled in Jerusalem for fear of Shishak. And he said to them, this is what the Lord says. You've abandoned me, therefore I now abandon you to Shishak. So there we have it. Rehoboam is established. And what is the result of the power and the prosperity and the popularity he's established? He and all Israel abandon the law of the Lord. So he turns away from the source of his blessing. He does exactly what Moses warned the people of God against as they entered the promised land. He allows his strength to degenerate into pride and self-reliance. Can you relate to that? Can you relate to allowing your strength to degenerate into pride and self-reliance? Moses issues a massive warning in Deuteronomy 8. When you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land he's given you. Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, his laws and his decrees that I'm giving you this day. Otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, and that was Rehoboam's experience, when you build fine houses and settle down, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God. In prosperity, our hearts become proud and we can forget the Lord our God. You may say to yourself, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me, but remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth. And in the midst of success and blessing, what is the temptation? It is to make God a footnote in our lives. In the midst of success and blessing, it is to say to God, I will not have you as the leading character on the center page, but I'll have you as the footnote. I will not have you in the driving seat, but I'll put you in the rucksack over my back and take you where I will. And that's exactly what Rehoboam does here. He says to God, you can become a footnote and I will go my own way. And not only that, in 1 Kings chapter 14, in a similar passage, we're told that as they forsook the Lord, as they turned against him, these people embraced the pagan practices of Asherah poles, high places and male shrine prostitutes. All these things are utterly detestable to the Lord, and yet they embraced them. That was the nature of their unfaithfulness. And then in verses 2 to 5, they live with the consequences of disobedience. God hands them over to be overrun by 1,200 chariots, 60,000 horsemen, and innumerable other troops, and a divine judgment for disobedience ensues. But then, in his mercy, and that's what's amazing about this passage, God is so merciful to Rehoboam. Again and again he warns him, and now again, just as he does with us, he warns again, and he sends the prophet Shemaiah to warn them. So we see in verse 6, here comes the prophet Shemaiah. This is what he says. The leaders of Israel and the kings humbled themselves and said, the Lord is just. After they've been warned in chapter 5, I now abandon you to Shishak, they humble themselves. And so, as they humble themselves, they receive a partial deliverance. And they're not totally destroyed and killed, but they learn what it is to live under a foreign king, verse 8. They will, however, become subject to him, to Shishak, so that they may learn the difference between serving me and serving the kings of other lands. And for the rest of his reign, Rehoboam lives under the shadow of this king. Yes, he is king, but he's a king who acknowledges the sovereignty of another king. And actually, verses 9 and 10 brilliantly sum up this reign as we finish. It sums up what happens in his reign in verses 9 and 10. When Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem, he carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including the gold shields that Solomon had made. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace them and assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance to the royal palace. What happens in his reign? Well, it's a reign that goes from gold to brass. That's what happens, gold to brass. It could have been so much better, but ultimately it went from failure to success to disaster because, chapter 12, verse 14, he had not set his heart on seeking the Lord. And so the question is, as we conclude, where's your heart? Where's your heart? Is your heart set on seeking the Lord? Or like Rehoboam, are you actually mapping out your own flight path? Are you actually saying, God, you can be a footnote, you can be in the rucksack behind me, but I will maintain my own flight path? And for the people of God, it was a terribly disillusioning thing to be led like this. Actually, it's a desperate thing, isn't it, to be led badly wherever you are. It's desperate to be led badly in the family, or in the community, or in business, or politically, or on a plane to Martha's Vineyard, whatever it is. It is a desperate thing to be led badly. And Rehoboam was a monarch who did not rule and rescue his people as a pattern for the coming Messiah king. In fact, he utterly failed to rescue them from the shadow of death. They were appallingly led. He did not guide them into the path of peace. They were led into division and subjugation under a foreign power. But wonderfully, he does not lead us today. Wonderfully, we as the people of God are not led by this man. If we look back to chapter 10, verse 11, can we just nip back to that? We see what his leadership was like. Chapter 10, verse 11. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it heavier. That's what he says. I'll lay on you a heavier yoke than my father. What does Jesus, our leader, say to us? What does he say? Come to me, says Jesus, our leader. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Will we not trust him to lead us? We couldn't trust Rehoboam. But will we not trust him? We have here a leader who will lead us out of the shadow of death. We have here a leader who will lead us to heaven. He does that by dying for us here, so that we may be forgiven, which is no small thing. Time and again, through the week, we do this. We say to him, be a footnote in my life today. Get in the rucksack on my back. We take him out of the centre page, out of the driving seat. And yet, constantly, he forgives us, he calls us back, and he leads us to heaven. George Piper, what an extraordinary thing to say on the night his beloved wife had died, that he could say, because of Jesus, my wife is now in heaven. Because of Jesus, I too will soon be in heaven. So will we not trust Jesus ourselves? Will we not trust him now as we come to communion and we remember that he died for us? Will we not trust him to lead us to heaven? And will we not be warned by Rehoboam, whose reign went from gold to brass because he hardened his heart to the word of the Lord? Let's confess now the times that we've done that, and let's put our trust in Christ to lead us to heaven.